cats, and I would have liked proof on Ed's memory. But what I actually said to him is, you must always join the side you're on. The title of my talk here this evening, and we can thank Don Lipset for it, is The West in Danger. Can hardly even be called a rhetorical question. Everyone in this room knows the West is in danger. Why else indeed are we here if not to take counsel about that very fact? Well, for friendship and camaraderie, of course. But the friendship and camaraderie each of us finds in this room are not accidental. Not, as Gatsby would have said, merely personal. They are qualities and experiences forged in a crucible of common anxiety. Necessarily common memory. As it happens, for instance, I cannot begin as Bill Buckley did last night with reminiscences, for I have none to share with you. My own are of another kind than yours. Less sweet, it seems to me. Certainly less amusing. Certainly more turbulent and troubled. The point is, we have all come, even if by separate routes, to the same sense of urgency. Speaking for myself, I would say it is a terrible sense of urgency, bred in the idea I cannot shake loose, that we have never been closer to losing that which it has been our unique historical privilege to be the guardians of. I mean, of course, nothing less than our very freedom. That freedom is nowadays threatened in many ways. Again, I need not list them all in this company. There is, for instance, no need to speak here of Soviet weapons and the almost uninterrupted brazen encroachments of Soviet ideology. Any reading of one's morning paper is a sufficient reminder of both. Nor do I mean to speak of the adequacy or inadequacy of the present administration in responding to those encroachments. Where I live, at least, which lately feels to me as if it is on the shuttle between New York and Washington, we have been speaking of little else for nearly a year now. Our disappointment in inverse ratio to our high hopes, the first in decades of a year ago. But there are dangers to freedom that the Reagan administration or any other administration can do nothing about, for they stem from our relation to life and reality. And it is one of these that I wish to call attention to today. In the end, I believe it is a far more intractable and possibly far more decisive danger than either the aggressiveness of our enemy or the so far less than forceful responses of our government to it. The danger I am referring to is that contained in a simple, deadly, corrosive question. This question, spoken or unspoken, is in the air all around us. It infuses our culture, it dogs the education of our children, and it seeps, unless we are eternally vigilant, into the very marrow of our bones. It is a liberal question, fundamentally, but calling ourselves conservatives will not by itself protect us from its simple, deadly, corrosive effect on our private spirits and on our public conduct. The question I mean is expressed in two short words. Put together and combined with the interrogative, they nowadays might just be the most potent words in the English language. They are, so what? As in, John loves Mary, so what? As in, a precious constitutional principle is being violated. So what? As in, the novel or film or play or music currently being touted as a profound masterpiece by our cultural standard bearers is actually a piece of meretricious junk. So what? As in, the citizens of X country enjoy freedom, the inhabitants of Y country do not. So what? One could nowadays apply this formulation in immediately recognizable ways to just about every area of life. Private, communal, national, international, to sex, to family obligations, to cultural standards, to our demands on public officials and our reading of their demands on us, and to our sense or lack of sense of responsibility to the world at large. The West Europeans are on a course of surrendering themselves voluntarily to the ultimate inroads of Sovietization. Well, let them. We can surely defend our own borders. Elections that do not produce the desired results can be negotiated away in the service of public relations or social convenience. Well, is that not the way the world really works anyway? Why kid ourselves? Each wedding we now attend feels not like a sacramental initiation into the tides and currents of man's fruitful sojourn on earth, but rather a throw of the dice. New set of social relations replacing the old. But there is one area of our social attitudes in which the cynicism and despair of so what seem to me to have become most particularly pervasive and threatening. This area, I suppose, is affected by the present government's failure to act, but the speed and ease with which it took hold in the first place must tell us something we cannot deny about the deeper, sickly condition of our national ethos. I am speaking about the near obliteration of what we refer to in the shorthand of public discussion as the idea of merit, and its substitution by the idea of group or class entitlement. This substitution is not, and never has been, as its proponents claim, an issue of justice, or even as many of its opponents claim, an issue of injustice. It is, and always has been, a matter of cynicism, plain and simple. We are facing a problem caused by the maldistribution of achievements and awards. Very well, then, we shall, by fiat, we shall declare the nature of achievement null and void. And do not deceive yourselves. Affirmative action is not a matter of employment and educational accreditation only. Tomorrow, as we see, it will touch the electoral process itself. Indeed, it is already doing so. And from there, everything. That is why a stroke of Reagan's pen, though it would make a very great difference, will not by itself suffice to rid us of this spiritual cancer. A basic principle dismantled will, like Humpty Dumpty, not so easily be put together again. And the basic principle here goes deeper than equality of opportunity, the one truly revolutionary discovery of the modern world, our nation's discovery by virtue of which we have been the one benignly revolutionary nation in modern history. Nevertheless, the principle goes even deeper than that. It is, like the question that undermines it, a blindingly simple principle. That reality counts for something. It has weight. It has meaning, and will not be denied. I have said that affirmative action, the most perfect expression of so what, is not merely a matter of employment and education. What I really meant is the message of this policy, a message taken to heart all over this society, that everything is a fraud, a racket, a deal, an arrangement. Work is nothing. Standing is everything. What one needs in this life, and there is not an issue of a woman's magazine, for instance, that does not somewhere carry an article or a passage of an article pointing this out. What one needs is not ambition, energy, training, and that one indispensable and completely incommensurable trait for success called, where I come from, moxie. One does not need these things. What one needs is a network. Old boy, old girl, or racial. Look at any list of grants awarded by major foundations. Look at any list of literary or journalistic prizes, of honorary degrees, of appointments to boards, of awards that carry gold plaques. You will see the work of a committee which by now does not need to calculate percentages, for they are imprinted on the very nervous system. Does all this matter? There is that insidious question again. It matters. Nothing more. Each favorable review, for instance, to take something that might sound not very important, each favorable review of a book the reviewer himself clearly knows to be bad, but is the work of a woman, or a black, or a homosexual, or just a wicked enemy of ordinary life, is a blow at the proposition that there is good and bad, worthy and unworthy, healthy and unhealthy, in short, at the proposition that life is worthy and has consequences. Each blow at this proposition produces another divorce, another deserted child, another decision to abort the fetus that amniocentesis reveals to be imperfect, another impulse to pull the plug on a sick parent, another homosexual, another mugging. Am I being extreme? All this from affirmative action? Yes. From the same sense of life that made affirmative action a feasible policy. All this, in other words, from so what? But what, you might ask, does this have to do with the fact that 300 SS-20s are pointed at Europe? That a new Soviet fleet sails the seven seas? That our European allies are, without saying so, considering the possibility of surrender? And that in order to wheedle them into reconsidering, we disastrously send negotiators to Vienna. That the Soviets have launched the most massive propaganda campaign in 3 decades to disarm us, and that we have had to stand by sheepishly as this campaign has swept across our own shores and thrown our populace and our politicians into deep confusion. The answer is everything. It has everything to do with these things. Those Soviet missile ships and lies are being armed in all the more deadly fashion by our own decay. We have not yet, applied our so dangerous question to the prospect of Soviet conquest, but we are coming close. I do not think in the end we would do so. But in the end, it's too late. A few years ago, the New York Times carried a story about a no-nukes demonstration at Princeton University. I think it was no-nukes. The occasion was forgettable, blended into so many others like it. What was unforgettable, however, was the news photo that accompanied this story. It was of a young man, healthy, vital, privileged, tanned no doubt by the suns of skiing in Vermont and beaching in the Virgin Islands. He was carrying a placard on which was scrawled the motto, "There is nothing worth dying for." His is the attitude touched on with such brilliant delicacy by Bill Buckley last night. He is our child, that young man. We desperately do not wish for him to die. But his announcement on that placard is an announcement about more than nuclear weapons, more than war. He who says there is nothing worth dying for says there is nothing worth living for. We as a society have some measure of responsibility for the message on that placard, for the fact that a young American, the healthiest, luckiest, most tenderly treated young man in history, at the height of his physical and sexual powers, marching around in that pretty, pretty town on a day of bright sunshine, we have some responsibility for the fact that he could find nothing of value save his own skin. Neither mother, nor father, nor kith, nor kin, nor country, nor God. Nietzsche said that he who values only staying alive has the mind of a slave. Until we take it upon ourselves to make that boy a free man, both free and a man, the continued survival of our own freedom as a nation will not be assured. Thank you.
Sessions adjourned. We'll reconvene in 7 minutes across the hall.